If they ask me, I could write a book.
If they asked me, I could write a book. Well, they did, and I did. I wrote a book, and I'm nearly done with a second one. My colleague, Don Smith, edited the first one, and he is the producer responsible for today's program. All this last week of 2016, we've listened again to conversations with people and on topics that matter to us. Don chose books and writers. That's what you'd expect from an English major, right? And he picked three Georgians, which is what you'd expect from a Quitman native. Robert Corum, who hails from Edison, has written a series of acclaimed military biographies, and he joined us earlier this fall to talk about his latest. Let's start at the beginning, which is, what exactly is a double ace?
An ace is a pilot who shot down 5 aircraft. A double ace, he shot down 10. There are very few of those, and they occupy a very hallowed place in the fighter pilot pantheon.
And yet there's a lot of, I guess, debate over how many planes Robert Lee Scott actually shot down. He himself didn't always give the same number. Why is that number change?
He took a lot of probables, that is, aircraft that he may or may not have shot down, and considered them victories. And there was a total of 23, I think. And
of probables.
He came back home after the war claiming 13 aircraft. But then the Air Force went through all the list of victories and they weeded them out in both the Europe and in China. And a lot of former aces were no longer aces. But Scott was downgraded from, I think, 13 to 10. So he officially is a double ace.
Now, he is often referred to as a flying tiger. The flying tigers were the pilots who were sort of this offshoot. They weren't officially part of the military.
Right.
They were in China fighting the Japanese. He was not one of the flying tigers, correct?
That's correct. The Flying Tigers were mercenaries. They were Army and Air Corps people who resigned their commissions to go to China to fight against the Japanese. And they were deactivated on July the 3rd, 1942. And then Scott's group, the 23rd, came online the next day. But Scott flew a P-40 alone, a P-40 with a shark mouth on it. And
that's the aircraft that many people recognize as the Flying Tigers.
One of the most iconic aircraft in history. And a lot of people assumed he was a member of the Flying Tigers, but he was not. And he always made that distinction.
Let's hear a little bit from Scott himself. A GBB aired a documentary about Robert Scott in 2011. He gave an interview for the film before he died in 2006. So here he is talking about the tension between him and the actual Flying Tigers you were just referring to when he tried to join the unit that was led by General Claire Chennault.
And at first they hated me because they hated regular officers. Being men are colonels, most of them have been lieutenants. Why do we want to follow you? I said, I want you to follow me. I want to follow you and learn the things Chennault has taught you. But then I began to fly guest missions with them. Later on, they became my friends and taught me all that Chennault had taught them.
And there actually has been debate over that as well, in terms of whether the Flying Tigers didn't like him or liked him. What did you find out on that score?
Scott got so much publicity, and he wrote a book that made the Flying Tigers immortal. I'm not sure their reputation would have not lasted had it not been for his book. And I think there's a lot of jealousy on the part of the Flying Tigers. They were unique. Group of brave young men who went up against insuperable odds, and they were winning in China when America was not winning anywhere else against the Japanese, and they were extraordinary young heroes.
And they were flying an inferior craft to the Japanese.
It was a hand-me-down aircraft that came from the British.
So, okay, let's begin with the legend of Robert Lee Scott. How did he become so good? This is a guy who failed out of high school, barely made it through West Point. How did he become such a great fighter pilot?
He was a mama's boy, and from the time he was—
That's putting it lightly, isn't it?
He was not 4 years old, and his mother told him what his life's work would be, that he would be a famous pilot. And she pushed him and prodded him, ignored her other two children. She played favorites and didn't keep a secret of it. And she pushed him to succeed. And he was much closer to his mother than he was to his wife. And she wrote him and talked to him constantly and, I think, made him the man he became.
And he had some kind of unconventional practice drills. I mean, many people may not remember that during World War II, this is the very beginning of military aircraft. And he would do practice drills with cantaloupe melons and all kinds of different things to practice actual air fighting.
His mother instilled in him a sense of his own destiny that one day he would go up against the enemies of his country and be a great fighter pilot. And to practice his bombing, he would carry melons up in his airplane and throw them out at circles on the ground that were used for bombing practice. And with his guns, he would shoot at sharks in the Bay of Panama, even at pelicans. And I'm not sure this is a true story, but he told me he got where he could, with one shot, shoot down a pelican in the air. But he became—
That would be incredible if that were true.
True.
Yeah.
He became, no doubt, he became the best shot in the Air Corps and one of the best bombers.
Okay, so since you've already brought up whether or not you know things are true, that is a theme that recurs over and over in your biography of him, is what we can confirm and what we cannot. Why is there so little that can be confirmed?
In the movie, The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, an editor says, this is a West, and out here, when the legend becomes fact, we print the legend. And most people prefer the legend when they talk about General Scott, because he built most of that legend himself. He was not burdened greatly by humility, and he could tell great stories about himself, and he had the Southerners' penchant for ignoring the truth. The story was more important than the truth, and it became true in the telling. So it's really difficult to separate what he said and what the legend was from the real Robert Scott. But at bottom, he was a famous war hero. He was a double ace and one of the most inspirational men of his time, and he wrote an iconic book. And in all the—
God is my co-pilot. That was the first use of that phrase
That was so his phrase, yes.
And the publishers did not want to use that title.
The publisher didn't, but the Jack Warner at Warner Brothers said, I would buy just the title. He thought it was the greatest title he had ever seen. And history has proved him right, because today you see it on automobile tags, bumper stickers. It's part of the lexicon, and it came from Scott's book.
Can you give me an example, because there are a number of them, of stories that he told where he himself didn't keep the facts straight every time that he told it?
Oh, there were so many of them. One, he made it appear that General Claire Chennault personally gave him a P-40 with a shark mouth painted on it. And according to the history of the Air Force or Air Corps at that time, it was a surplus airplane that was just parked on the runway. And Scott was a colonel, a senior guy, and he just took it over and made it his airplane. But General Chennault did not give him the airplane.
So, I mean, you start the book with that sentence, he was a hero,
yeah.
Almost in a way where you feel like you need to set that out from the beginning. He was not a great husband and not a great father. We're going to get more into his role with the Aviation Museum. But on balance, he's a hero because he inspired people with his book or his flying?
His book, primarily, because a book lives on. And as with many military people, his reputation and legend is attenuated over time, but the book hasn't.
So, Robert, you mentioned a number of times about different facts in your book about what we think happened in World War II and how we get it so wrong. Why, with all the attention that's put on World War II, all the movies and TV shows and books about that particular war, why do we get so many things wrong?
I think history is rather trendy, and every generation of historians finds something new or something different that they want to write about. And one good example, Jimmy Doolittle in the spring of 1942 took 16 B-25s off an aircraft carrier and bombed Japan. It was a wonderful psychological uplift for the American people. We needed that. But recent historians have said that because 3,000 Chinese were killed in reprisal, all the aircraft went down, that the juice wasn't worth the squeeze, that raid was just, it shouldn't have been done. It wasn't worth it. So history changes with time.
I want to play this comment from Oliver Bateman. He was one of the Flying Tigers, and I want to reemphasize that Robert Lee Scott was not a member of the original Flying Tigers. But here's Oliver Bateman talking about that movie, God is My Co-Pilot. This is for a GPB documentary that aired in 2011.
We didn't have anybody winning on the American side at that time. The Flying Tigers were the only folks that were winning, and it was a great morale booster.
After that movie came out, the military took Robert Lee Scott out of the air. And people questioned, why would you take our deadliest fighter pilot out of combat? Why did they do that?
That brought him back home and put him on a war bond tour. He traveled America raising money and war bonds for the effort. And there's a lot of absenteeism in the defense industry, and he spoke to galvanized defense workers. He later went back to flying, and he flew most of his life in the military. That was one reason he was slow in being promoted. All he wanted to do was fly.
That wasn't the only reason, though. He wasn't exactly a good soldier.
He had some disagreements. He did pretty much what he wanted to at every step in his life.
His second life, he helped build the largest aviation museum in America. He raised $20 million to establish the Museum of Aviation, which is in Warner Robins, Georgia, of all places. Now the second largest?
Second largest.
In the United States. Here is former U.S. Senator Sam Nunn speaking for that 2011 documentary.
What General Scott helped instill in the museum was that you build the character and the quality and the courage day by day. Then, when you have a chance to serve the nation, whatever it is, whether it's in the military or whether it's a scientific development or whether it's teaching a young kid in school, all of those things require dedication and energy and character.
So he himself, General Scott, said that the museum saved his life. What does he mean by that?
He was in Sun City outside
in Arizona?
In Arizona, and he called
it— That's a retirement community.
He called it Depressionville. He said people there were just waiting to die. And he was prone to depression. He was in a deep depression at the time. And he got a letter from Warner Robins. It wound up, he's coming back to Georgia when he was 82 years old. He packed up and moved all the way across country. And he was given a job, and he was venerated in the Air Force. They let him fly on every airplane in the inventory. And he was the face of the museum, the head of the fundraising campaign. And he personally, more than any other individual, is responsible for that museum in what it is today, the second largest in America. More than 500,000 people a year visit there. It's got one of the greatest collection of aircraft in the country.
So we've got 1 minute left. On balance, I mean, I want to say again, you start this by establishing Robert Lee Scott was a hero, and yet he was flawed. I think that's putting it mildly. So on balance, what was his greatest legacy?
It was a book, and we're all flawed. And I think heroes live at that nexus of the human and the divine. And Scott slid decidedly toward the human end of it. He had many faults. All of us do. His were more noticeable because he was so famous. But we have many faults. But we should never forget that he was first, last, and always a great American hero at a time when America really needed a hero.
That is biographer Robert Corum. His latest book is called Double Ace, The Life of Robert Lee Scott, Jr., Pilot, Hero, and Teller of Tall Tales. Such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Coming up, what's a nice person like Karen Slaughter doing writing about all those people and all those murders? And setting her crime thrillers in Atlanta? It's next from On Second Thought. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. We're giving a second listen to some of our conversations with Georgia authors during this rapidly ending year. And one of our state's biggest names in books is Karen Slaughter. Originally from Jonesboro, she spent most of her life in Atlanta. She's popular, more than 35 million copies sold in 36 languages. She's prolific. Since her first book, Blindsided, in 2001, she's written more than two dozen more. And the latest is The Kept Woman. Can I just ask a question out of curiosity?
Maybe.
Do you read books digitally or do you use the actual paper copies?
Well, you know, I've been on my tour for a couple of weeks, and when I travel, I like the digital copies. But
right.
I got home, I was in the middle of a book, so I bought the book so I could finish reading it in paper because I guess I'm old school.
Do you prefer that people read your stuff in a paper copy versus digital? Does it matter?
It doesn't really matter. You know, there are a lot of people who just like the format. There are some people, you know, who have arthritis in their hands and can't hold a heavy book. You know, the audiobook is another great great way to read it. And some people have vision problems and they don't have time to sit and read. So I think it's great no matter what they're doing.
So this book focuses on a character with, in large part, that is not well-liked. This is Will Trent's ex-wife. And this is a no-spoiler interview. But I will say that Angie, who is his ex-wife, is a big focus, probably shares equal billing to a certain extent as Will. Why?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I wrote Angie to be a polarizing character, and it's always fun for me to see the people who love her and the people who hate her because they feel very strongly about it. And, you know, that was very by design on my part. I'm a bit alarmed, though, on my Facebook page. Sometimes I'll see readers say, oh, Will should be with Angie. And you think, boy, she's an awful person. Why would you want Will to be with Angie? I think that they just find that badness interesting.
Yeah. So I wonder, why is Georgia a particularly good place to set a crime? Is there anything about the area here? Because you have many of the thrillers are set here in Atlanta, which is a real place. And then you have, the Grant County series, when that's a fictional place. But is Georgia a good place for crime?
You know, I think so. We're not Chicago, thank goodness, but we do have a lot of people who are doing bad things. And we basically know the neighborhoods to stay out of where a lot of the bad stuff is happening. But, you know, it is a vibrant city. There's a lot going on. We've got a very diverse and a culturally diverse city here and, you know, a lot of wonderful people. But fortunately for me, we also have some bad guys.
And what's the difference in writing something that's set in a real place as opposed to setting it in like Grant County, where you can just make everything about the city up?
I wrote Grant County thinking I was being really clever and then I wouldn't get these letters about how you can't turn left on Main Street, but I still got them. I had this one guy.
Seriously? Yeah,
he kept writing to me saying, you can't go to Florida through Grant County. And I said, please show me on a map the route. yeah, people just want to find fault, I think. Some people do.
So it's basically this, you thought it would be different, but
it
isn't.
Yeah. And it's actually harder because, you know, it is an actual city, so I do try to get everything right. And then I wrote a novel called Coptown set in the 70s, and all the street names have changed since then, especially in downtown. So I had to go back and look at old maps.
So what makes thrillers such a best-selling genre? What keeps pulling us back to police procedurals and crime thrillers?
Not to sound glib, because something happens. You know, a lot of books, you read them and you think, well, what was that about? I mean, it's not even done in a clever way. It's just navel-gazing. And I think, you know, if you've Gone with the Wind, The Great Gatsby, Crime and Punishment, all of Dickens, there's some kind of crime there that propels the story. And I think it's a useful tool for a reason.
Okay, so then what makes women so good in this genre? Because, you know, in general, publishing and writing is a pretty male-dominated, even today, very male-dominated. And yet in the thriller category, we've got you. We've got Tess Gerritsen. Who else? We've got Lisa Gardner. We have a ton of women who sell millions of books in the thriller genre. Why?
I think that there are a lot of good guys out there, too, but that women know how to scare women. It just doesn't occur to men, the things that terrify us. So we all know a creepy guy who we've worked with, and the guys think that he's great and just a little quirky, and the women are thinking, you know, he's probably got pieces of hair in his refrigerator that he's pulled off the floor.
My guest right now is author Karen Slaughter. Her latest novel is called The Kept Woman. And this particular novel does focus a lot on women's issues of domestic violence, issues of rape. Did you have to think strategically in how to handle those issues carefully?
Well, I always think very carefully about how I'm going to write about things, you know, what to put on the page, what to leave off. I never want to write to titillate. But someone did say, wow, you know, you're writing about an athlete and sexual assault. That's really topical. And I started writing this book a year and a half ago, and it was topical then. It's topical now because it's just something that keeps happening. You know, we have really great athletes here in Atlanta who are wonderful, and the majority of them are fantastic guys. But some of them are rapists, and some of them get away with doing really bad things. And it's not a matter of being an athlete. It's just a matter of having a lot of money. And that's how society is. It's it's really, I hate to use the term rigged, but we really do help wealthy people along, especially in the criminal justice system.
And there is a lot of questions about morality in this novel, because there are people who justify supporting that athlete by saying, look, there's too much money at stake. I don't agree with what they're doing. It's distasteful or whatever, but there's just too much money in the balance to make this go forward.
Well, there are a lot of stakeholders in an athlete's life. And yeah, I see that to a small degree as an author. You know, I have an agent and managers and people like that who help with my career. But athletes is such a huge level, and it's such a massive amount of money for a lot of these people. And most of them have never had this kind of money. So there's a lot of people in there who are telling them the wrong things or telling them what they want to hear.
So when earlier you said you don't ever want to titillate people. How do you keep that balance between shock and surprise and suspense and don't cross over into titillation?
I think every author has their own moral compass. And, you know, for me, I don't want to describe an act in a sexualized way. I want to show violence for what it is. And I think that's a fine line for some authors. I think as a woman, you know, I'm more likely to put myself in the woman's position in the scene, and I'm not going to find rape something that's really titillating. You know, it's terrifying. It's all these horrible things. And I think that capturing the emotion of that and the fear of that is much more important than writing about, you know, this happened and this happened and this happened.
Do you sometimes get inspiration from some of the real headlines that you read, or do you just try to come up with things all on your own? I mean, I guess sometimes I imagine a thriller writer sitting down and seeing a headline about a particularly either heinous or weird crime and going, okay, that's my next book right there. Does that happen?
You know, a little bit. I'm really cautious because I never want to take someone's worst awful day and put it into a book, because I'm writing for entertainment. I mean, we're talking about heady things here, but really, it's a page turner. It's suspenseful. It's fun. It's entertainment. And so I don't want to feel like I'm exploiting someone. And I'll take bits and pieces. A lot of times, though, what I'll see is something so horrible and horrific that I could never put it in a book because no one would believe me.
What? You mean you find crimes that are so awful that you don't think people would find it believable?
Oh, absolutely. You know, even Anne Rule, when she wrote about
the true
Ted
crime,
Bundy,
yeah,
she struggled a bit with that. She left some details out about things that he did because they were just too horrific.
So how do you keep up the pace? Do you end up having to schedule it like going to the gym or something? Writing, I mean. How do you keep up the pace?
You know, I do have to schedule it. I travel quite a lot. I've been on my U.S. tour, and I'm doing an event in Gwinnett tonight. So I have to make sure that I'm doing stuff for me, which is writing. I love writing. It's my passion, and that's my fun time. And so I have a cabin in North Georgia, and I go up there, and I just sequester myself and just write and write for a couple of weeks at a time. And that's really when I'm the most happy.
You need quiet.
I need quiet, absolutely.
Which you can't find in your own regular house.
Well, you know, cats can be a little intrusive.
They sit on your keyboard a lot,
they do.
Don't they?
They want attention. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So you take like a couple weeks and you can knock out a novel. Well, you've probably been keeping notes before that.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a couple of weeks at a time, you know, and it can
take
several trips up to the cabin to do this throughout the year. But like most people, my deadline is the last day of the year. So I have a very, very busy fall.
Right. Okay. So let's get back to the genre of thrillers in and of itself, because it fascinates me to a certain extent, sometimes the balance. You were talking about the difference between, say, titillation and real fear. And I wonder how you yourself arrive at that. Is your measure what scares you but doesn't disgust you? How do you find that and then make sure that that's going to be the same measure that works for your readers as well?
Well, as much as I love my readers, you know, it's been great going to libraries and bookstores these past few weeks and meeting them and talking to them. I never think about them when I'm writing. It's just me and the story. And I am a prolific reader of crime fiction, thrillers, all kinds of books, really. I'll read anything. And I write the story that I would like to read.
And that's it.
That's as simple as it is, yeah.
And when you get to the end of the book, Do you then think about, gee, maybe this is too much for someone else?
I don't. But it's interesting because I get a lot of readers across different generations, men and women. And I think that actually young women who grew up watching CSI and all these crime programs, and there's a real appetite for them. And they're very savvy and they want to know the truth. And I don't take shortcuts in my book. You know, I'm not going to make up some scientific thing to make the story move more expediently. I really talk to police officers. I talk to forensics experts. I talk to medical examiners and doctors. And I want it to be as realistic as possible. That's a really important component to me of the novels. I don't want someone who's a nurse to say, wait a minute. That never happens. You know, I want it to have that realistic feel. And, you know, I think it's important and that people appreciate that. And that's, obviously what they want to read.
How limiting is that, though? Are there times when you're tempted to take a shortcut?
You know, I have to honor what's going on in the medical field or whatever I'm writing about. But I think everybody understands that you can't write a textbook. You know, I had one, I asked my doctor who advises me about putting in a chest tube, and it was 16 pages, right? And I had to make it 2 paragraphs. So, you know, I think that they understand, but they know that I'm trying to get everything right.
So when you are coming at your characters, then what about the balance between staying what you think of as true to that particular character and also allowing them to progress and change?
That's important to me. You know, I decided a long time ago when I first started writing my Grant County books about Sarah Linton, who's in the Will Trent
series
now.
Sarah Linton, the coroner / pediatrician.
Yes. I thought... I love serialized stories. And actually, that wasn't very popular when I first started out. I was kind of ahead of that curve. You know, you had The Sopranos, but Breaking Bad and things like that, where it's serialized and people change
right,
over the course.
Right, one long story told,
exactly.
Broken up into bits.
And that's how I think about the character's journey, for lack of a better word. You know, Sarah is really affected by what she's seen. And the Sarah you meet in Blindsided, my first novel, is very different from the Sarah you meet in this Will Trent book, In the Kept Woman, because she's seen a lot of really horrible stuff. I mean, more horrible stuff than any one medical examiner would ever see, let's be honest.
Yeah.
She'd be in a mental home, right?
But people should not move to Grant County if it were real.
No, there's a reason why she left. But, you know, it is fun to see them change and grow. And I have another character, Lena Adams, who's from Grant County, and she shows up in some of the Will Trent books, and she's a very different person. You know, she's grown older. I wouldn't say she's grown wiser, but she's learned from some of her mistakes. And that was a choice on my part, is I wanted to write about the violence in context and show how it changes people.
So, I mean, we're talking about thrillers that have been turned into TV series. Is that coming down the pipeline for any of your...
I hope so. The Will Trent series has been optioned by Yellowbird. They did the Millennial series, and we're working on the script right now. And Coptown has been optioned as well, and they just found someone who's interested in being a showrunner. So it could be very exciting, or it could be nothing at all.
Now, Coptown was a standalone novel.
Mm-hmm.
So they would be just turning that, or is this the kind of thing where you might end up writing TV scripts?
Well, I would hope to eventually, and I have always wanted to write a sequel to Coptown. And I think after this book that I'm working on for next year, which is called The Good Daughter, it's another standalone, I'll definitely go back to Will Trent. But then the one after that is definitely going to be a sequel to Coptown.
What makes you want to write a sequel? Is it the characters, or is that there's still things left unresolved in stories?
It's both. You know, I love the characters in Coptown because they're just two amazing women, and they put up with a lot of crap in the 1970s and to be police officers. And I want to check in with them and follow them. And, you know, the 1970s in Atlanta was such a fascinating time. This was a tipping point for us. And we had one of the most amazing mayors in any city in maybe the world, Maynard Jackson, who really guided us through a very awful transitional time. And he kept everybody intact and kept the city whole. And I think it's amazing what he's done. And I want to talk more about that transitional time.
Now, we only have about a minute left, but you are part of the effort to save the libraries in DeKalb. What kind of reading town or reading state, I guess, is Georgia and Atlanta? Are we a good
writers and readers area?
I think we are. You know, we have some fantastic writers here. Kitty Stockett, Susan Rebecca White, Kathy Hogan Trocheck. I mean, we're really firing on all cylinders here. Kathy writes as Mary Kay Andrews. But, you know, they're huge library supporters. Every author I know is always going to say yes when a library needs help. And that's what we've done in DeKalb, and we've done that for other libraries too.
That's crime novelist Karen Slaughter. Her latest is Kept Woman. We said Karen Slaughter is popular. How popular? Number 8 in Amazon's mystery, thriller, and suspense category. We checked Karen's website. All you Will Trent fans will be happy to know Karen's first book in the series, Triptych, will be the first one filmed. Karen will write the screenplay, and it's expected the feature will be shot where it should be, right here in Hollywood South. Another native Georgian saw her work adapted for the screen and then the Broadway stage, The Color Purple. She is Alice Walker, and my conversation with her is next. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. To mark the centennial anniversary of the Pulitzer Prize, in 2016, we featured a series of conversations about Georgia winners, and we called it Pulitzer Peaches. Today, we revisit my conversation with author Alice Walker. Her rural upbringing in Eatonton has had a heavy influence on her writing. She became the first African-American woman to win the Pulitzer Prize for fiction in 1983 for her novel, The Color Purple. I spoke with her back in October when she was in Georgia. Here's an excerpt from that conversation. It is a real honor to welcome you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you for asking me.
I think that many people who love your work, and I have to imagine that's the way, as an artist and a writer, that's the way most people, general people, know you, although you're incredibly active and have always been in activism. I think people sometimes forget your history as part of the civil rights movement, which goes back to your days as a student at Spelman. Can you explain to me what that path was like? And what I mean by that is, at the same time that you're learning how to become a novelist and a writer, you're also focusing a great deal of attention on activism. You're taking time off to lead voter registration drives. Were those two separate paths, the art and the activism?
Well, no, you have to understand that if you're going to be an artist, you need to, for instance, be able to make a living. And if you can't make a living except doing, you know, chores that were specifically designed for just black people, then that is not, you know, that's not a good thing. So you have to go against the culture that is actually forcing you to do things that are likely to make it impossible for you to be an artist. So, for instance, one of the things that still prevailed when I was growing up was that I couldn't try on a dress in a store, you know, on the main street. And that could really upset your whole life, not to mention the day, you know, that your mother brought you into the store.
So let me take you back then, since you mentioned growing up. I read one place where you said you had to hide your writing from your family. You started writing when you were about 8 years old?
Sometime early, yeah.
Why did you keep that secret?
Well, when you grow up in a family of, you know, lots of people.
Yeah, you were the youngest of 8, right?
7 brothers and sisters. And a very, very, very small house, and very little paper. So it was better to keep things from my two brothers, who were very likely to, you know, want to intrude and read and laugh and whatever. So I learned to write in my head much more than on paper for many, many, many years. And in fact, I almost never did drafts until quite late in my writing life. I preferred to compose things almost entirely in my head and then write once, and you know, that would probably be it. But it would take a lot of work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can imagine. Do you think that has, in the end, affected your writing style?
Um, I, don't know. I mean, I would imagine everything you do affects, you know, what you produce.
Yeah.
But it helped me because it saved a lot of trees. And I was glad of that because I always loved trees. And I just liked the reality that people, human beings, are so beautifully made that we can hold an awful lot in the mind and work on things in the mind, and you know, and there's a freedom to that, so that often you can just avoid a lot of things that are going on around you because you have a world that is full in your own imagination.
I wanted to ask you about Zora Neale Hurston, who seems to have been a constant influence for you. And I mean, people said that you almost single-handedly rescued her from obscurity. You went and actually found her gravesite back in the 70s. You've had a link with her most of your life. What draws you to her?
Because I didn't have a link. She died when I was a junior in high school. And I had no clue that she'd even existed when I went away to college at Sarah Lawrence in New York. My teacher had known her, but never mentioned her. And her name was in the first book I was published in, but because, you know, at that time we thought only the men were writers, I never even noticed. And so years later, when I discovered that she had existed, that she'd written Their Eyes Were Watching God, and I adored it, I couldn't believe how she had been so, forgotten by people who had known her and so ignored. And then to discover that she'd also been vilified and very badly treated. So, yes, I loved her so much, and I went to Florida, and I found the only sunken place in this huge field that could have been her grave, and that was, you know, a wonderful thing for me. I felt, that was something that she really deserved, and now people love her, and they go there by the thousands every year.
You know, I wonder, Zora Neale Hurston could have been a cautionary tale if you had seen her that way, in terms of being careful about the way that your activism and your political voice may influence the way people see you and treat you. And I wonder if you ever thought about that. You've been so active all your life, and you have never shied away from putting that into your novels and your poems and all of the other writing that you do. Did it ever concern you that it might affect the way that you were treated, or whether you were published, or the way you were reviewed?
Oh, well, yes, and it has of course affected, you know, everything my whole life. But what you learn is that it is such a joy to be able to speak what you see and to share what you know, that it's worth the consequences. So I've always felt that. And I think she did too. I mean, in her case, it was to show the beauty of African-American Southern culture. And she was going to do that whether people liked it or didn't like it or whatever they had to say about her. She paid the price, and I think you just have to be willing to accept that whatever other people do is their business. You know, your business is what the mission that you're on, and it's not something that's negotiable, really. I mean, it's just who you are and what you are put here to do.
So, in your book, Possessing the Secret of Joy, since we're talking about joy here, this is a book that's it's difficult to read, and I don't mean the writing itself is difficult. It's that you are talking about the issue, the practice of female genital mutilation, in parts of Africa and the Middle East and other places, and you do not shy away at all from graphic depictions. It's a beautiful book. But it's hard for me to imagine how you came at the beauty and the language with such a topic. And I wonder if you said you don't write drafts, but do you go back and on a book like that to make sure of where that line is?
Oh, yeah. No. By then, I was doing drafts. I was just explaining that in the beginning, you know, I didn't do many drafts because I had learned to be very careful of you know, people intruding, and also we didn't have a lot of money to spend on paper. But no, of course, as I went along, I could afford paper, and I could afford drafts, and I could throw things in the waste paper basket. But yeah, with that particular book, it's just that I love little girls. You know, I love children, and I couldn't imagine. I learned about this when I was in Kenya, when I was, in my 20s, I guess. And it was so shocking that I just hid it from myself for decades. I couldn't imagine what I could do or if anybody could do this. Because we're talking about millions of children, and so I worried it and worried it for a long time. And then I realized that it was obviously something that I had been trained to do, to write about this. My background was so poor and so hard, and yet somehow my parents and my community had sent me off, and I had become educated, and I could write, and then the universe had said, well, here, look at this. And so it was clear to me that I was there. I had the tools, and I should do this work. And I did it, and I'm very glad. I know a lot of people have been very unhappy. And, I've heard from a couple of the surgeons who do this in hospitals in the West, for instance, in London and New York and, other places, which, is shocking enough.
Yeah.
But they, they had thought that instead of doing it in an unhygiene way, we should do it, hygienically in our hospital, as if that helps the child later on who has to grow into an adult who has to deal with the consequences of being mutilated in this way.
A lot of scholars say that novel, Possessing the Secret of Joy, is part of a trilogy with The Temple of My Familiar and The Color Purple. And I wonder if that's how you intend. I mean, scholars are writing about them that way, but I wonder if that's how you intended them.
No, I don't believe in sequels, and I don't believe in trilogies for myself. Other people can have them. But no, I mean, it the characters sometimes are, Tashi is in on one page.
Tashi's the African wife of Seeley's son from the novel Possessing the Secret of
Joy.
Right. Yeah.
But this is her story, and it's not really... But on the other hand, if people want to read it that way, I really don't mind. I mean, read it however you'd like. But I don't... I remember when we made the movie of The Color Purple, and they were wondering and wanting a sequel. And I said, absolutely not. I mean, I don't want any spin-offs. I don't want, to wake up one day and have, some crazy, idiotic sentences coming out of anybody else's mouth. Seeley's or Suge's or Sophia's or Mister's. It would be horrendous. Because each work comes as a whole, complete thing itself. And you don't have any plots and plans, I mean, at least I don't, for trying to spin it off into something else. I have to be really drawn to each individual subject and each situation, and then I give it my full attention for a couple of years.
Now, you've described yourself as a womanist as opposed to a feminist. What does that mean? What's the difference?
Well, I'm an African-American. My adventure, and actually it has been an adventure, but... reality here in the United States is very different from that of a white person or a white woman. So, there is feminism, which is a valid thing, and I am fine to be a feminist, but womanism means that I incorporate and that I stand firmly in my tradition as an African-American woman and what that has meant.
Is that a response? There has been a lot of complaints from women of color that the feminist movement, the new feminist movement, is a largely white female movement and is sometimes insensitive and sometimes openly aggressive to the struggles of women of color. Is that part of what you're responding to?
Well, I think the truth is really that know, what we're seeing is something that has been going on all the time, is that, generally speaking, I think many white feminists have seen the struggle to be equal with the white man, and that is to basically, you know, be a bit above everybody else as a couple. And this is the history, you know. I mean, that is just the reality. And I think many women of color and other, you know, women in the world have assumed that feminism meant that your loyalty would be to all the women of the planet. It wouldn't be to, you know, marry the top guy and then rule over everybody else. But what seems to be, you know, somewhat unsettling is the notion that the white woman who comes to consciousness about her own, you know, inequality because she's female is actually wanting just to be equal with the man who's on top, i.e. the white man, and therefore not loyal to the other women of the planet, and in fact often is detrimental to them. For instance, in the government, where often white women who come to power don't seem to be all that conscious that the countries that they, you know, talk about bombing are full of women. You know, they are full of women and children. So what kind of feminism is that? You know, I mean, to be consciously aware of women and children would mean that you would not say, as Hillary did at some point, we will obliterate Iran. You can't talk about obliterating, you know, a country and all the people and still say you are a feminist. I mean, what are you talking about?
Alice Walker, such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was my conversation with Pulitzer Prize-winning author Alice Walker. I spoke with her back in October. Pulitzer Prizes are awarded in a number of categories. Three Georgian novelists have won. Carolyn Miller in 1934 for A Lamb in His Bosom, Margaret Mitchell in 1937 for You Know What, and Alice Walker in 1983. The state is very well represented in other creative categories as well. Savannah poet Conrad Aiken, Atlanta dramatist Alfred Ury, who gave us Miss Daisy and Hoke. Historian Taylor Branch won in 1989 for Parting the Waters, volume one of a colossal trilogy about Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And more than 20 Georgia journalists have taken the prize as well. That's our show for today. We hope you enjoyed these conversations with three distinguished Georgia-born writers, Robert Corum, Karen Slaughter, and Alice Walker. Tomorrow, our last broadcast of the year, we invite you to share some talks about food. And it's a very interesting list of foods: oysters, watermelon, biscuits, and green peanut oil. If you're driving to your New Year's celebration, please be careful and make sure you have a designated driver if you need one. We heard a few bars of I Could Write a Book at the beginning of this hour. Here's a more generous portion sung by the inimitable Dinah Washington. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great day.
If they ask me, I could write a book about the way you walk and whisper and look. I could write a preface on how simple.